Okay, it's good to see you again today. James chapter 5 is going to be our text tonight, so I encourage you to be making your way over there to the last chapter of the book of James. We're going to be reading the first 12 verses together. James chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded, and their corrosion will be evidence against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have laid up treasure in the last days. Behold, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you. And the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you. Be patient, therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it till it receives the early and late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. But above all, brothers, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation. Now, the man who wrote these words, inspired by God's Spirit, saw a whole lot of injustice in his life. James grew up in a small town in Israel, seeing, or at least hearing about, the sins of the Roman soldiers and the Roman governors who occupied the land that he lived in since before he was born. He always understood that leaders were oppressing the Jews. And when he grew up and he came to believe that his brother, his half-brother, Jesus, was the Son of God, was the Messiah, and he became a Christian, he experienced persecution from that angle as well, as he tried to speak his faith and live it in a society where both Jews and Greeks did not want the gospel to be spread or lived. And according to tradition, James himself would be killed in about AD 62, when there was a transition of Roman governors in the land. The Sanhedrin Council took that opportunity to get a trial together, and they brought James before the trial, and they sentenced him to death, and they took him up to the pinnacle of the temple, and they threw him down off of it, and when that didn't kill him, somebody took a club and finished him off by bashing in his head with a club. So James, when James speaks to us about suffering and about being patient through trials, he knows exactly what he's talking about, both because God is giving him words, but also because he experienced this his entire life. And so if you were going through a trial, or some kind of suffering in your life, or you are discouraged by the sins of other people, sins against you, then James' message will really hit you tonight, because he says you need to establish your heart and be patient until the time when God ends that suffering and that feeling of fruitlessness. The bigger picture for God's people is that our righteousness is being invested in heaven, waiting for us, and it's going to pay a whole lot more than any stock that we could have bought on the earth. God will pay dividends, but we might not see it for a while. Got to figure this out. There we go. So let's go to these verses and look at them in depth. Let's look at the first six verses together, where James begins this discussion by talking about not Christians, but the rich people, the powerful people, the people who have influence in their society, who are persecuting the Christians. And he has some very strong things to say about them. James is looking around here, I believe, at the Jewish leaders of society, the Roman leaders, the Herodians, anybody who does not want Jesus and his message to spread. And so you might recall from our study of the book of James that James gets pretty worked up sometimes in this book. This, to me, is one of the most worked up moments of this letter that he sends out to these different churches and Christians. He is very, very strongly, aggressively condemning the rich. He mentions what they have. They have gold, they have silver, they have garments, but they're all going to be corroded and moth-eaten and come to nothing. And James, of course, is not condemning the rich people for being rich and for having things, but he is condemning how they got that wealth and what they have done with it. You notice, they are rich partly because they're not paying people like they should. They're holding back the wages that are rightfully the property of the laborers who are mowing their fields and taking care of their things. And they have a total disregard for the value of human life. Mentions that, you know, you murder the righteous one, which sounds an awful lot like what happened to Jesus. He does not resist you, he says. Jesus did not resist what happened to him when the Roman leaders and the Jewish leaders decided, we're going to get rid of this pest of a preacher, and we're going to crucify him, and we're going to kill him. Righteous people, from Jesus on out, they don't resist. What we're told is, turn the other cheek, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you. We're not going to fight back as God's people. That's not our job. It's not our role. And evil people, when they realize that, they sometimes take advantage of that. And so these people have wealth, they have power, but they are only living for themselves. Remember, see in verse 5, you have lived on the earth in luxury and in self-indulgence. But again, James zooms out and looks at the bigger picture and says, but in the grand scheme of things, all you're really doing is you're fattening yourself up. You're like a cow getting bigger and bigger and bigger, eating off all this wonderful grass in the pasture. But all that is just preparing you for the day of slaughter when you're turned into steak. And so he says, look at where you're going here. And so God tells us not just that these are bad people, but that he will take care of those who are oppressed by the bad people. God always defends the helpless. And the warning that God gives these people is almost spooky to me. Because did you notice in verse 4 where he says, the wages of the laborers, which you kept back by fraud, are crying out against you. The coins that they unlawfully kept back that are still in their dresser drawer or their chest or wherever they have it around their house. See the mental picture here? The coins are crying out, we know what you did. Would that be a little bit scary. If the money lying around your house started talking to you, that's the mental picture we get. The wages are crying out, as well as the people to whom they should have paid those wages to. The people who are being oppressed are also crying out. They're in verse 4, the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. Notice how God addresses himself. He describes himself not just as God, you know, but they've reached me, but I am the Lord of hosts. You know what a host is? It is an innumerable force. It's a word that's used to talk about armies in the Old Testament. And so God is saying, I have an innumerable host of people that I can use to fight against you. And I'm coming for you if you don't turn around and if you don't repent. God's army is always bigger. God's power, God's influence is always larger than anybody else who has a voice or who has riches, or who has power. This reminds me so much of Genesis 4. Remember when Cain killed his brother? And God confronts Cain. And he doesn't let it go. He doesn't shove it under the rug. But he confronts Cain. And he gives Cain an opportunity to come clean. Cain doesn't. But you remember what God told him when he finally let Cain know that he knew about what he did? Genesis chapter 4. Remember in verse 10. The Lord said, "What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground." God knows exactly what people have done when they sin against him. No matter who it is, no matter how secretive it might be, God will curse anyone who dares to harm his children. From the very beginning, that has been true. And that is certainly true of us as well. And so, James turns his attention away from the rich people, the powerful people who don't care about Jesus or God's cause, and he addresses the Christians who are being persecuted by these people, and he gives them some instructions about what they are to do. They can't necessarily throw off the unrighteous people at the moment. But here's what they can do. They can understand the big picture, like the rich were supposed to do. And the first thing he says, starting there in verse 7, is, and notice how many times he says, be patient, 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 patient. The word pops up over and over in this text. And so he uses a picture of patience. And that is a farmer. A farmer who goes out and he sows his seed and then he waits. And he waits. And he waits. And he waits some more. And he waits some more after that. And then finally, months down the line, after, you know, a season or two has passed, finally he gets a harvest. And he reaps what he has sown. But just imagine if you're a farmer and you go out and you sow that seed and you look at the field weeks later, maybe even a month or two later, depending on what you have sown, nothing might be happening, at least on the surface. It looks as if sometimes that the farmer's work has had no effect whatsoever, that soil doesn't have anything green popping up out of it, and so sometimes, from the farmer's perspective, it looks like nothing's going on. But he knows, it says there in verse, at the end of verse 7, be patient about it until it receives the early and the late rains. The farmer waits without worry because he knows the rain is coming, and then he knows the harvest further after that is going to happen. The crop is going to grow. And so he does what he's supposed to do with confidence. And that is exactly the kind of attitude we need. I don't know what kind of work in God's kingdom everybody here is doing throughout the week. Obviously, when we come together and we talk to each other, we get more of a glimpse of what we're doing out in the rest of our week, in the rest of our the communities that we live in. I know a lot of work is being done. So I don't know if you ever face points in your life, points in your week, where the work that you're doing seems to be fruitless and pointless. And it looks as if you've been sowing all your seeds and nothing's coming up out of the ground. But God says very clearly here, the rain's coming. And you might not see the harvest for a long time, but it is coming. And God will reward you when Jesus comes to reap his harvest. And that's when he says, establish your hearts. There in verse 8, you also, like the farmer, be patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. So how do we do that? How do we establish our spiritual hearts to wait for God? The first thing he points out in this process is we've got to make sure that we don't allow our temporary suffering or pain or anguish to cause us to be cranky toward one another. Okay, did you notice that? He says in verse 9, and verse 9, if you don't read the context, seems like a really random command. What does this have to do with anything? Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. At first glance, we wonder, why is he talking about grumbling at this point in the text? But if we think about it, it makes a lot of sense. When we go through discomfort and pain, what is our natural reaction? It's to lash out at other people, even if they're not the cause of our pain. You ever stubbed your toe really badly, and you cry out in your pain, and your family members rush into the room from the other places in the house, and they, oh, are you okay? You know, what's your immediate reaction? Does it look like I'm okay? Didn't you, see what happened? Do you understand what's going on? Why are you asking me such a stupid question? You know, our natural reaction is to do that because we want to shut down the pain. When we can't shut down the source of the pain, we try to shut down the other people around us as a poor substitute of that. And that's what we do spiritually too, isn't it? We're going through family difficulties, or we're frustrated in evangelism, or we're working in God's kingdom and we're doing things and they don't seem to be producing the kind of immediate results that we want. What do we want to do? Lash out at other Christians. But don't, he said, don't do that. Don't grumble against each other. You know, when the Israelites went through times in the wilderness, when they were sick of the manna and they wanted water or they wanted meat and they didn't have the leeks and the onions that they so enjoyed back in Egypt, what did they do? They grumbled against Moses and Aaron. Even though Moses and Aaron were just the mouthpieces of God, they weren't the source of the problem, but they received the grumbling. Usually, when the Israelites did that, there were pretty serious consequences. Sometimes God sent a plague. Sometimes God sent fire to burn up parts of the camp. Sometimes, God sent snakes. God did not ignore the grumbling. And notice in verse 9, God still to this day does not ignore grumbling ever. Because he says, don't do this so that you may not be judged. And where is the judge? He's standing right outside the door, ready to open the door and come in. You know, God is very close to bringing this world to an end. We are in the last age. Any moment now, Jesus is coming back, descending from the sky, to take his people home and to judge the unrighteous. Any minute now. And so he says, you might be frustrated when your life might be going in a direction that you hadn't envisioned it to go in, but he says, don't use that as an opportunity to beat down the other people around you. They're there to help you. They're there to strengthen you. They're there to encourage you, and you them. So don't bite the hand that feeds you. Don't shoot yourself in the foot by shooting other Christians. And so the other thing that he says, in our efforts to establish our hearts, to prepare ourselves for the coming of Jesus, he says something that strikes me every time I read it. When he says there in verse 10, as an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. The prophets of the Old Testament are perfect examples of people who went through years and years of looking out in the fields and not noticing anything green popping up. You think about, when you go back and think about the different prophets that God had sent to the Israelites, think about men like Hosea. You know, Hosea was told by God, I want you to go out and find yourself a prostitute and marry the woman and have a family with her. That was a command. That was not an option. That was a command given by God. So Hosea did that. He had a family of kids with her. And then she went off and committed adultery. He was told to love her again, buy her back out of the slavery she had gotten herself into, and use your family as a living illustration of what the country of Israel is doing to me. Because I'm trying to do that in my relationship with Israel, God said. Hosea had to live through all that. And he had to watch as his message was preached very loudly, very clearly, and totally ignored. And so if you're Hosea, you look around at your family life and you've got suffering. You look around at your country and it looks like you're doing no good whatsoever. And Hosea had to watch as the Assyrians came down and destroyed his country and yanked everybody out and moved to Assyria. He had to watch all that happen. You think about men like Jeremiah, who was thrown into a mud pit. He lived in hiding for a portion of his life for fear of the king. He was forcibly taken to Egypt after warning the people, look, we need to not go to Egypt. We need to stay here as what God's will is for us. He's ignored. He's taken down to Egypt. Jeremiah looks around. He doesn't see any visible demonstrations of seeds coming up out of the ground. No, it doesn't look like growth is happening. Guys like Elijah, hated by the royal family of Israel, took a stand against Ahab and Jezebel and showed very clearly on Mount Carmel that Baal is not God and Yahweh most certainly is. And yet, what changed after Mount Carmel? There was no revolution. Ahab and Jezebel still on the throne. Baal is still worshipped. And Jezebel sends a message and says, I'm going to kill you for that. Does it look like he's doing any good? No. So there, we might think that we have it tough in our lives in certain portions of our days. And yet when we go back and we study the prophets and their words and their actions, that gives us a lot better perspective on the kind of picture that God presents for his people. Here's the point. God has always had hard workers that didn't get to see the results of their work, but that did not mean that the quality of their work was bad. Sometimes we think, if we don't see seeds popping up out of the ground, we think, well, I must be doing a bad job in my efforts to do God's work in different places. It does not mean we're doing a bad job. It just means that we need to be patient until the seeds come, and they will come, is what James keeps saying in this context here. So look at the prophets. Look at their work, and don't be discouraged. And remember the blessings, he says, that comes out of steadfastness. And he mentions another example of a man that we all know very well, I'm sure. This man named Job, he says in verse 11, you've heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. And at the beginning of that verse, he says, we consider those blessed who remained steadfast. Now, would you describe Job as blessed for having gone through that horrific trial that he went through? When you look at his life, does he look like a blessed man? We could look at the very end of that story, or that narrative, and you notice at the very end of Job, we are told by God that many of the things that he lost were restored to him. So the kids that were killed in the beginning of the narrative, he had more children. The camels and the sheep and everything that he had was restored. But the primary way Job was blessed was that he gained a new appreciation of how to wait for God. Let's go to the book of Job for just a moment, and I want to go to the end of the book with you, to Job chapter 42. I want to read several verses of what Job says when God comes to confront Job, after Job has been saying throughout the whole book, I want to talk to God, because I know I'm in the right, and if I could just have a conversation with God, I know I could set the record straight. And so at the end of the book, God shows up and says, hey, Job, you rang? You want to talk to me? Let's talk. Where were you when everything was created? And so Job is completely humbled. And after he has heard God out, and he tries to make God not go into the whole conversation that God does, but God goes through several chapters of where were you when. And in chapter 42, verse 1, then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak. I will question you, and you make it known to me. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. He gained the capability of being able to wait patiently, steadfastly for God because he went through that trial and learned lessons from it. You know, when we began this study, the very first lesson I preached in James, in chapter 1, we talked about the very first things he says in the book about counting it all joy when you meet trials of various kinds. And he says, let, verse 4 of chapter 1, let steadfastness have its full effects, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. We made the point when we studied that this kind of character quality is not something that we can put on our New Year's resolution list and just decide one day we're going to get it. I'm going to be more patient this month. This kind of character quality can only be ours if, when we go through a trial, we learn the appropriate lessons in the middle of the trial, like Job did. It's like we cannot wake up one day and say, I'm going to go outside and I'm just going to see an eclipse of the sun today, because I feel like that would be a good thing to do. No, we have to wait until the eclipse happens, whenever that does happen, and then we get to look at it. We can get patience only when we go through a trial and we learn through it. That's why trials are such a blessing, he says. We consider those blessed who remain steadfast under trial, like Job did. And that's why, at the end of verse 11, he says, you've seen how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. You look at Job's story, God doesn't look very compassionate, does he? At first glance. But God is compassionate and merciful because he leads Job to this new character quality that he couldn't have had any other way than by going through this trial and seeing God at the end of the tunnel at the very end. So that's what we need to remember when we go through a trial, he says. There's a point that I meant to put on the slide. It didn't get on the slide. But the last point there that he mentions in verse 12 is, don't be deceptive in your speech. Verse 12, when he says, above all, don't swear by heaven, by earth, by any other oath, let your yes be yes, your no be no. When James tells us not to swear, I don't believe he is telling us don't use swear words in coarse language in our society. There are scriptures that talk about that. This, I believe, is not one of them. Here he is saying, don't take an oath, don't make a promise to cover up falsehoods. Like the example of Peter when he betrayed the Lord. Remember, Peter, when he was waiting outside watching Jesus get tried, he swore that he did not know the Lord, when in fact, obviously, he really did know Jesus. So it's that kind of thing James is condemning. When you're going through suffering, you're going through trial, stand up for what you believe. Live the truth. Don't try to cover up who you really are. Stand out from the crowd is the message here. And this reminds me very much of what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 34 through 37. Jesus preaches this same message of let your yes be yes and let your no be no. People took oaths in the scriptures. Godly people took oaths. But they never did it to conceal the truth. And so as we pull all this together, as we think back about the rich people and what he says about where their riches are going to end up versus where the poor and the persecuted are going to end up, we have to ask ourselves, when Jesus comes, and he is going to come anytime now, where is our treasure going to be? Is it going to be invested in corroded, moth-eaten possessions? Or is it going to be invested in our spiritual life? And Jesus said in Matthew 6, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Establish your hearts, and God will bless you. Thank you for your attention. If you need to reach for the eternal joy that God offers to you in the gospel and you need to accept the message of Jesus, please let us help you to do that tonight. If you need to come back to Jesus, please let us pray for you. Let us help you any way that we can as together we stand up and we sing the invitation song together.